Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Town, and Gene DiNardo. Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know that talking about a revolution sounds...
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with the co-host Jake Town and Gene DiNardo on this Thursday, January 26, 2012. And here are the headlines we're looking at this week. First, we'll be looking at the President's State of the Union speech and doing a little fact-checking on it. But a lot of what we're talking about today are the numbers regarding the monetary system and the economy, including unemployment numbers, a special report put out by John Williams of Shadow Stats. And we're going to start off with what is being touted as Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve being more open about what they're doing. Jake has the details on that. Jake?
Yes, the Fed is always trying to be more transparent, but they never seem to actually do it. Yesterday, the Federal Open Market Committee came out with a statement saying that the near-zero federal funds rate, near-zero percent interest rates for the bankers, not for the people, is going to persist possibly through late 2014. The stock market reacted. Actually, there wasn't a huge reaction from the stock market. It did go up, but not by a major amount or anything. Gold did shoot up a couple percent. Silver also did as well. The Bernanke also gave another of his press conferences, and he laid the groundwork for a third round of large-scale asset purchases should unemployment remain higher. He did state that it is... that it, quote, recognizes the hardship imposed by high and persistent unemployment in an underperforming economy and is prepared to provide further monetary accommodation, unquote. So in English, they're going to give more money. They're going to print up more money and give it to the bankers because they have in the past created bubbles which have caused all the unemployment.
Well, that would make sense. Sure, why not?
Well, that's not in their words, of course, but that's what's pretty much going on. The Fed is claiming that inflation is under control and will range from 1.4 to 1.8% this year, which is probably big news to people that are buying food or buying gasoline or buying health care insurance.
Oh, that doesn't count.
Yeah, those are non-core. the whole thing is that this there was one vote of dissent since he just didn't want to say what the time period was, but what they all agree on pretty much is continuing to provide monetary accommodation. I think another one of the main factors in this decision is that this is a election year. And this is a year where the Fed does not want to cause any problems for the current administration. All of the Republican frontrunners have pretty much said that they would demand Bernanke's resignation, which is probably something in the back of his head that makes him say, unless he wants to get rid of his job at some point, to stay in power. So.
Yeah, and who are they going to pick?
Right.
Maybe they'll handle the job themselves, you know.
Yeah, name themselves. Yeah, that would work.
Yeah.
But, there's really no big change. This is, again, not something new for the market or anything like that. Really, like I said, the only new thing is saying that they're going to keep these interest rates at near zero for a longer period of time.
Now, Jake, you mentioned that that's for the large banks, that interest rate, and you're pretty well versed in this, but I'm curious about this myself, and I'm sure the listeners are interested, but if this rate, which is like, what, 0.02 at present, something like that? Or
yeah, it's actually a range in between 0.0 and 0.25%.
But 0.25%. Well, I'm curious what is a 3-month Treasury bill going for?
3-month Treasury is probably a little bit. I would say, actually, I can quick look it up. I know a 10-year is right around 2% U.S. Treasury.
What I'm getting at isn't the mechanics of this. The Fed is basically paying these banks to borrow money from the Fed and then loan it back to the government.
Well, yeah, that's potentially
at a profit.
Well, and a profit at everyone else's expense.
At everyone else's expense. So they're not using any of their own money, and yet the Fed is paying them interest.
This is good for our unemployment, you see.
Yeah, for their employment, right, the bankers.
Well, speaking of unemployment, while Jake's looking that number up, why don't you give us what the latest numbers are on unemployment, because that should certainly show how well the Fed is doing, right?
Yeah, exactly. They kind of dipped over the past week, 21,000, or actually unemployment increased. 21,000 more Americans claimed unemployment benefits, the Labor Department reported. Apparently that's bad news, and it's obvious that it is. The good news, reports the AP, is that the four-week average is down 2,500, which still, this is their quote, which still signals a healthier job market. So 2,500 people have been employed in the last month that weren't before. The Commerce Department also has some good
2,500?
News. 2,500, that's what they're bragging about.
That's
healthy? Supposedly.
Okay.
And that would be healthy, you know, maybe at 2% unemployment, I guess. The Commerce Department also has some good news on the economy. Orders for durable goods rose 3%, and they put a lot of faith in durable goods because they figure people are making long-term purchases. AP also reports that this marks a gain for the second straight month and adds that perhaps the best evidence of that was a 2.9% increase in so-called core capital goods, such as computers and machinery. This pushed total orders for the category to a record almost $69 billion, $68.9 billion. Economists goes on to say economists pay most attention to so-called core capital goods because they are often viewed as a good way of gauging business investment plans. And, of course, another way to look at that is just pent-up demand from people not or companies and people and firms not purchasing things for the last 4 years or 3 years. So
basically, going back to the 2,500 figure, because that one really caught my attention, in an economy where, according to most of the government experts who track this kind of thing, the economy has to be growing something like 150,000 jobs a month, something like that, in order to keep up with population growth. In that economy, we've had an increase of 2,500 jobs, so that's good news.
That's very good news.
Well, now that we have that ironed up, Jake, let's go back to you with what's going on with how the banks are making money on the Treasury bills.
Right. The Treasury interest rates currently, the interest rate on a three-month is, right around 0.02, 0.03, so that's 0.03%. Basically zero. The 10-year bonds are right around 2%. 1 year bond is at about a tenth of a percent. So it's extremely, extremely low. In effect, what they're getting is money for free into the future.
Right. They're not trying to sell the short-term ones. They're trying to sell the long-term ones, or actually the medium-term ones, the 10 years.
Yeah. And the Fed also said their Operation Twist was going to continue, which is just kind of swapping out the longer term for the short terms. But what's also going on is that recently the TIPS sale that they just had of these are U.S. Treasuries, but they're indexed for inflation. They came out as a negative amount, I think like negative 0.4%. So what that means is that investors are willing to pay, really they're really willing to pay the U.S. government to have these TIPS bonds for any inflation spikes in the future, because that would be the only way that they would make money on the principals if inflation shot up. And it's a pretty amazing story.
And in fact, they couldn't even cover it anyway. I mean, if that were to happen, if the inflation were to spike up, there'd be no way for the government to cover those.
The printing press is the only way.
Yeah. Very simple. Computer keyboard.
But, the last sale was about a week ago was a record $15 billion in 10-year Treasury inflation protected securities. As a negative yield for the first time in recent years. It was not negative 0.4, it was negative 0.04. so it's actually a pretty small negative amount. But again, the whole reason for that is that they're playing on the future of that yield being a lot higher because that interest rate will vary.
They're betting on inflation, right? Right.
Well, isn't that just special?
Well, you sound a bit tough.
Actually, I saw an article at futuremoneytrends.com. It wasn't so much an article. It was actually an audio interview of Jim Rickards, who I know Jake knows. I'm not sure, Gene, if you know who he is. He's basically a gold bug. He's an investment banker, investment counselor, analyst, all that kind of thing. In fact, he has advised the Department of Defense and the U.S. intelligence community, and he also participated in the Pentagon's financial war games. Interesting stuff. And he's the author of the book Currency Wars. But he had an interesting take on what's been going on with the financial markets and what's been going on with the monetary system. I just wanted to quote some of the article to you because this article touches on a number of really interesting points. And they involve things like Iran, Libya, and the monetary system and the possibility of QE3. So let me just kind of flick through these. First of all, regarding Iran, he says basically when you're looking at Iran, you start from the point of what you know because most of analysis has to do with what you don't know. So he says, what's the one thing we know? Well, the one thing we know is that the West does not want Iran and will not allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon. So we start there. He says, okay, so what's going to happen? Well, there's going to be a variety of different ways to deal with them. What are they? One is diplomacy. A second is sabotage. Third is regime change. And fourth is just plain going to war. He says, well, diplomacy has failed utterly. Sabotage is having some success, but not enough. He doesn't really see regime change as being an option because the regime is so ruthless that it'd be almost impossible to pull off without another Arab Spring type thing. He gave a really awful example. He says they buy cranes in Iran from European and Asian manufacturers. And you know what they use them for? They use them to hang people.
It's a waste.
Unbelievably ruthless regime. So he says basically that means the only thing left is war, and that's what's going to be happening. Now he says regarding Libya, Gaddafi had over 100 tons of gold, and now he's gone. But where's the gold? He says, I don't know. I would love to know. It's a very interesting question, and I'm sure it's highly secret information. It's probably in a vault somewhere under U.S. military control. I'm sure we're going through the motions of saying that the gold is available for the new Libyan government, but what is the new Libyan government? We see civil war breaking out every day, so I'm sure no one is going to hand that gold over to a particular faction only to find them using the gold to finance the military operations and their revolutionary operations. Now, this is a guess, he says. I don't want to pretend that I know this because I don't, but it's probably under military lock and key somewhere. The play in Libya, he says, was not just about oil, although that was the main play. It was also about gold. Very interesting. And then about QE3. Now, this comment, this interview took place before the Bernanke announcement yesterday. So it is a little bit of a prediction of what Bernanke was going to say, and he was right on, as it turns out. He says, I think there will be another round of quantitative easing by late spring or early summer. They may not call it quantitative easing. They may call it nominal GDP targeting. That's a mouthful, but what it means is when you calculate the gross domestic product, it has two parts. It has a real part, and it has an inflationary part. You add them together, and you get nominal growth in GDP. You could have an economy growing at 2%, but you could have 3% inflation. When you add it together, 2 plus 3 equals 5. So the actual number of dollars goes up by 5%. That's nominal GDP. And he says what the Fed is saying is, let's get nominal GDP up to 5 or 6%. And, oh, by the way, if the real happens to be 1% and 4% happens to be inflation, well, we don't really care. That's a technical way of saying they're going to inflate their way out of this. They more or less admitted that. They would still be using the bond market to buy bonds using freshly printed money, but the difference between that and QE, and remember, QE money programs targeted specific amounts and specific dates. During QE2, they said in November 2010 that they were going to buy $600 billion in government bonds before 2011, and they did, June 2011. They're not going to do that this time, in my view, he says, because it locks them in, and then people start counting the clock and saying, well, it's going to be over in 6 months, and then what are you going to do? What are they going to say, in effect, is, well, we're going to do whatever it takes. We're going to get you QE, but we're not going to put a time limit on it or an amount on it. We're just going to do whatever it takes to get to the desired nominal GDP to create enough inflation to pay down the debt. So it's just plain an inflationary program, and that's what he sees coming by Mayor June. And, Jake, it sounds like that's exactly what they were talking about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and just to highlight kind of what you were saying about Iran, that whole situation is disintegrating pretty much. And it wouldn't surprise me if he is ends up being correct on the entire war scenario, which I think is going to have very dire implications for world trade. Because right now, the way it is, like the European Union decided to pass a oil embargo, so to join with the United States over its nuclear program to ban all new oil contracts with the country. So they're being more and more sealed off. The EU currently buys about 20% of Iran's oil exports, which is, of course, their main export. So they're rejecting the payment of euro for these at some point in the future. And you know, as far as the market goes, as long as the like people are kind of wondering why oil hasn't spiked over 100 very much at this point. And I think that a lot of that the reason for the rise is really the risk of the military conflict is going up. But the Iranians still have some way to get it on to the world market because, as long as they're able to sell it to somebody else, China or Russia or whoever, it'll get on to the world market and keep the price down. And I think that all the people passing the embargo do have this kind of in mind. They're just trying to put as much pressure as they can. India has been mum. A report by the Times of India has reported that it's possible that an Israeli intelligence website has claimed that India is opting to use gold to repay crude oil supplies from Iran, since the payment in the gold, which is a hard currency slash barter good, instead of using the U.S. dollar or euro, because if they use the U.S. dollar or euro, it'll get nixed by the U.S. banking, or at this point the euro banking system. So, there's a heck of a lot going on here. Internally, again, like we reported last week, there's massive inflation, and the people of Iran are really seeing the rial, their national currency, its purchasing power disintegrate because of these sanctions. These sanctions also include food and medical supplies to the civilian population. So you have, the so-called very goody two-shoes at the UN, passing an embargo that is really going to be affecting the people, which is something that, theoretically the United Nations shouldn't be doing, but the fact of the matter is they don't give a damn. they really, the same thing happened in Iraq. The people were subject to a multi-decade sanctions before before they got invaded and bombed out, and I think they're starting to look at doing the same thing to Iran, which is very unsafe. Iran should be able to close the Straits of Hormuz, which will cause all types of havoc with the oil supplies, but they probably won't be able to keep it closed forever due to the might of the United States Navy.
And is there an inspection coming up, or has that already happened?
I have to look that up. It's something that we sure aren't going to hear about on the mainstream media. I believe it was scheduled for late January, which is like right now.
Yeah, and that's a very important thing. I mean, if they go over there, of course, same thing happened in Iraq. They go over there and they don't find anything. That should be something everybody should know about.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point.
But like you say, we probably won't hear about it, or it'll be just in a little sideline of the news.
Sideline of the news.
Well, they couldn't find anything, but we know it's there.
Yeah, okay. Right. Yeah, the senior UN nuclear inspectors will be visiting Iran next week, so I guess they moved it back just a little bit.
They had to give Iran time to get to work that gold deal with India. That's what it was.
right. This is reported by the Chicago Tribune, and what's kind of funny is that even the language used in the first sentence is propaganda. It starts off, a rare visit by senior UN nuclear inspectors next week raises pressure on Iran to address suspicions it is developing atomic weapons. Though Western powers that are piling on sanctions expect no significant breakthrough. You know, and again, I think probably the three of us agree, Iran is ruled by a despot, has no freedom of the press, very little freedoms. It is, you know, pretty much a totalitarian regime. They're just a lot poorer than other regimes like the United States.
A lot poorer.
But, you know, the Chicago Tribune used, you know, they called it a, quote, rare visit, which is not true. Like, Iran has had the most surprise nuclear visits of any country that I'm certainly aware of, and I think it's any country on the planet, and they've passed each and every single one of them. So, we hopefully the results of this audit will be published and will be made available. Certainly, I'd be highly surprised if they can find anything that they're doing.
Interesting thing. I saw an article on a Middle Eastern website, news website, and I can't find it quickly here. But in general, the columnist was he's a Muslim, and he was arguing that what happened in Libya with Gaddafi basically has made it virtually impossible for the U.S. to try to talk the Iranians out of nuclear weapons. And his explanation was a couple of years before Gaddafi was taken down, he backed off on his own nuclear program at the behest of the Western powers led by the U.S. in exchange for basically being left alone. And then 2 years later, along comes the Arab Spring, he gets knocked out, and he gets knocked out with the assistance of the West.
That's interesting.
So that basically signals, President Obama is what this particular columnist said, but really it's all the West, signals Iran that, well, that ain't a good way to go, so there's no point in backing down.
That's a great point.
No, that's I think that is a very good point. And, you know, it wasn't until... You know, for many years, Gaddafi was pretty much treated as a, persona non grata here in the United States. And Bush and Obama ended that because Gaddafi cooperated with addressing al-Qaeda in the war on terror. And, you know, people have to remember that just before that visit, he was actually visiting over here. He had his tent set up, I think, on Donald Trump's estate or something like that. Up in New York State, he addressed the United Nations, which, you know, was a debacle. But the whole idea of him being removed by power by force, and you know the way the UN went about it. And, you know, again, I guess I'll criticize the UN, which is another way of saying criticizing our own country as well. Is that the UN said, okay, we're going to put in a no-fly zone so Gaddafi can't bomb his civilians. So the UN puts in the no-fly zone. Sure enough, you know, shoots down the Iranian aircraft very, very quickly. They didn't really have an air force too much to speak of. And then they proceed to bomb military sites. But there were plenty of civilian casualties and civilian, you know, collateral damage caused by the United Nations bombing and all the arms that were flooding into Iran that was provided courtesy of the West. So... You know, it's very hypocritical because at the end of the day, you know, sure, Gaddafi gets removed, but the people are the ones suffering. The overall situation in Libya is worse than it was a year ago for certain. And I would agree with that. I think that Iran sees that, and certainly, I would say if hostilities commence, they're going to be doing whatever they possibly can to advance their nuclear programs, because at that point it's going to be like, well, we're either going to get a nuke and use it to battle these guys or not. And, you know, Israel itself is kind of like the main driver in all this, which is, you know, a very small nation of 7 million people. Really, the United States is its only ally. They're in relative isolation, and Israel can take care of itself. I mean, they have a paranoia among a lot of the population that, they need to address this nuclear threat. But I think at last count, Israel had like over 300 nuclear warheads. They can blow Tehran off the map if they so choose. So it's not as if Iran did get nuclear weapons that Israel would be in any danger whatsoever. I think that Iran will probably actually be made safer if they have nuclear weapons, because people wouldn't be so apt to go in and blast away at them. I mean, take a look at Pakistan. Pakistan would have been taken out by the U.S. military, and you know, we did a lot of military excursions into the western part of Pakistan, you know, pursuing and blowing up insurgents and civilians both. But in their case, you know, they didn't have to worry about invasion from the U.S. Army or anything like that, because they have nuclear weapons.
It's an interesting point. Go ahead, Gene. Did you want to say something?
I think that's a great point. And, you know, it just propels them to develop some kind of nuclear weapon just to defend themselves when they see the aggression. But the other thing that is really a huge question mark is, if the West does commence aggression against Iran, what Israel would do. And, you know, that could just be a terrible result. You know, I'm sure there would be some coordination, but still.
I kind of expect that Israel would be kind of leading it.
I think that Walt's correct on, like, actual physical attack using conventional weapons and what have you. Israel would be the leader in that. But, you know, you have to remember, we made this point on our show, I think, a few weeks ago, is that economic warfare is still warfare, and we are, you know, destroying their currency. The assets of all these Iranians worldwide are either being destroyed via purchasing power or confiscated. They're being cut off from food, medical supplies, refined oil, because, you know, Iran does not have a single oil refinery, so they, you know, their military would be in a lot of difficulty. And, you know, all these sanctions, you know, when the ports of the South were blockaded by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, that was an act of war. When the British were blockading our ports during the Revolutionary War, that was an act of war. And what's going on right now, sure, it's more modern. Sure, there's no actual guns involved, but it is still it's still warfare.
No, it's apparently the same thing.
Undeclared, of course, which Libya was also undeclared. And that's, I think, one of the main problems for the American population is, you know, you have a Nobel Peace Prize winner in power who has launched and continued several wars and military actions, and really kind of has the go-ahead, more or less, from a very compliant Congress to just, blow up Iran. He just said the other day that all options are on the table, and yeah, he gave some lip service to a diplomacy, but they are not using diplomacy. Diplomacy is something you use before you try to cut off people's food supply.
Yeah, a very hawkish speech, too, I thought. I mean, you could hardly say that it was a Nobel Peace Prize winning president giving his latest speech.
I guess peace has a new meaning today. We'll have to delve into this after the break, because we need to take care of a little business for PRN, and then we'll be right back. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be back after these messages.
Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
Turn it up. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour. And as a reminder, you can always check out the latest and greatest on our show, but checking it out in advance, that is, by going to the website, www.freedomnewshour.com. You will also find many of the archives from previous shows and information about three of us, so be sure to check it out. And if you have a comment, believe you can always do that, too. Guys, before the break, we were talking about what the situation is with Iran and the similarities and differences with Pakistan in terms of nukes and what a nuclear weapon has done for Pakistan, actually about 100 of them. I had actually written an article about this about a week ago on the Nolan chart. Basically, the point of the article was to say that Ron Paul understood the situation with suitcase nukes better than his opponents, or really better than anybody else. And the gist of it was kind of what we were talking about here, that Pakistan has nukes, and basically they leave people alone, and we leave them alone for the same reason. And if Iran had the same situation, you know, they would end up in basically the same place. And had a comment from a reader who said, well, you know, Pakistan, they're just going to leave us alone anyway, so it's not a big deal. And But Iran's a different situation. What's a different situation? It's the same situation.
That's very similar.
I mean, how can I honestly don't understand the hawks sometimes. It's like they have this blind spot. But anyway, that just kind of struck a nerve with me when you guys were talking about that, because it was like a deja vu all over again. Also, I wanted to touch on the hyperinflation report that John Williams put out. And Jake, give us the details on that, because this is something he does every year, and it's got some interesting stuff in it this year.
Yes, for the listeners that aren't aware, John Williams runs shadowstats.com, which takes the traditional statistics provided, of course, by the United States government, such as inflation and employment and the money supply, and endeavors to really put out those figures in an unmanipulated manner. So to take the government's past ways that they calculate the figures and use them in today. And what you find is that the inflation rate is much higher in actuality than what the government reports, which, again, is to the benefit of the U.S. government. It, number one, takes care of a lot of the expectations, and the Federal Reserve needs those expectations in order to be able to operate with abandon in their bank bailout programs. And also, number two, just very fiscally, one of the largest expenditures of the federal government is Social Security. And up until this year, Social Security was frozen for a couple of years. This year it had a small increase. But in all cases, these increases are smaller than the rise of inflation. So in such a way, they're endeavoring to kind of profit, so to speak, from the Social Security stuff by paying out with dollars that are worth far less than the dollars that are paid in previous years by the retirees and also the current workforce. Let me go on the Social Security, how it's a Ponzi scheme. But what he came out with just a few days ago was his 2012 hyperinflation special report, where he kind of maps the progress of the U.S. dollar towards hyperinflation. And hyperinflation is defined as inflation that, you know, isn't even 10% or 20%. Hits actually four digits, like 1,000%. And this is, you know, what happened to Argentina in past years, Zimbabwe, I think, most recently. And what he writes is kind of like the scenario of it, which is, quote, further easing by the Fed is likely in the months ahead. We were just talking about that. As the ongoing economic turmoil triggers significant further fiscal deterioration, these actions should pummel heavily the U.S. dollar's exchange rate against other major currencies. Looming with uncertain timing is a panic dollar dumping and dumping of dollar-denominated paper assets, which remains the most likely event as a proximal trigger for the onset of hyperinflation in the near term. The early stages of hyperinflation would be marked simply by an accelerating upturn in consumer prices, a pattern that was already was initially in response to QE2. Money supply velocity will spike as the U.S. dollar again comes under heavy and even disorderly selling pressure, with both domestic and foreign holders getting rid of their dollar holdings as quickly as possible. One factor that could contribute to rising velocity is the current circumstance where U.S. investors cannot get a safe return that beats inflation, as reported by the government. Investors can do better by buying historic products that are rising in price rather than by holding cash or a treasury bill, unquote. He goes on, and the rest of the report is kind of filled up with the charts and stuff outlining it. And I think you can access the report at shadowstats.com. I think the reader has to take it with a grain of salt as well, because you know, he's been predicting this for a few years now. I think that ultimately that's kind of where things are going, but how long it's going to take or what is the path to get there could be very different, because the government obviously wants to keep the shell game going for as long as possible. And really what we see, whether it's in the European Union or the United States, is they're sacrificing the long-term fiscal status of the governments, or even medium-term fiscal status of the governments, in order to get short-term relief to kind of keep everything under wraps, kicking the can, so to speak. And that I don't think is going to stop. And what we've seen, you know, with the debt levels of the U.S. government and with the deficits, is beginning to hit the exponential slope where the interest rate starts growing very much higher than everything else. But like we just talked about earlier on the show, the U.S. government controls the U.S. Treasury market by using the Fed. And the Fed has been able to successfully keep these interest rates extremely low. Like, you know, like Gene had asked, the three-month Treasury is less than a tenth of a percent. So they are getting this credit relatively easily from anybody else who's not the Fed that's purchasing and buying it. And I think that in the longer term, you know, sure this could happen, but in the shorter term, which is probably 1 to 3 years, it's a possibility, but I don't think it's that strong of one. I think what you're going to see is, you know, hopefully what we're going to see is just the continuing, you know, the gold price increasing, the prices of everything else increasing, but at a slow rate. That'll give people time. But again, with all these hyperinflations, kind of like the wild card to triggering them is kind of what he refers to in the report, is kind of like a mass kind of like herd event. And that's what the expectations and the psychological aspects of having the Federal Reserve out there, you know, telling everybody everything's safe. That's why it's so important, because, you know, if overnight everybody in the United States actually figured out what's going on, that the government bails out these banks in order to fund wars and also to pad the pockets of all these investment bankers, there would be, but their money in the banks is not safe. It's not really insured by the FDIC in any way, form, or fashion. I think then you would see a very quick collapse. But at this point, it's not there. But there's a lot of expectations. You know, you can kind of go onto the street and talk to just about anybody, and the expectations are kind of in place for this event, this mass psychological herd type event to occur at some point.
Well, I think I agree with you. And I think what people miss when they talk about hyperinflation of the dollar is they look at, like you mentioned, Argentina. All these hyperinflations a main cause of them was the relationship of their currency to the dollar. And when they're, you know, and everybody, if you want to go back to Argentina, when that did happen, and it actually happened a few times, I think, but the most recent one was the worst. I can't remember what period that was. But, you know, everybody was trying to get the dollar, you know, because the dollar is the world currency. So this is the main strength of the dollar. And to say that the dollar is going to have hyperinflation is basically saying the economy is going to collapse, because there wouldn't be anything to turn to. And you know, I agree, it's certainly a possibility, but I also agree with what you said. In the next coming years, we probably will have inflation, but the actual, you know, inflation of the dollar or loss of value of the dollar of a third or a half is unlikely in a short period. But it is a continued weakening, and it will continue in place because of the system, the way the system's geared, and they do it for the reasons you mentioned.
Right, and you know, the dollar has been the world's reserve currency for a very long period of time, really since World War II. And it isn't really until like the last several years that we start to see very marked movements away from using it as a reserve currency. And these things take time to occur.
Right.
The rest of the world is very, very much aware that if the U.S. dollar goes down, it's really not going to be that much pleasant for themselves either. So they're just trying to what these central banks end up doing is inflating their money or devaluing it kind of in step. And, you know, we just talked about on our show, I think, late last year, how Japan and China and how Russia and China are both moving away from using the dollar as a reserve currency and using their national currencies instead. And these things, you know, I think in many ways it's kind of good that they're taking place, and it's also kind of good that it's gradual. But... at the end of the day, you know, you have this money printing guru, Ben Bernanke, in the Fed, and it's kind of unknown exactly what this guy is going to do. And this is also kind of pure conjecture on my part, but, you know, you have to remember all the governments are kind of in this game together, so to speak. And, you know, we just had, you know, late last year, you had the Federal Reserve bailing out European banks and providing dollar swaps in order to prop up all these massively bad banks that are in the European Union. And you know what happened recently or what happened yesterday? So the EU all of a sudden decides, hey, you know, we're going to join your oil embargo on Iran. You know, thanks for the dollars. It's kind of my personal thinking. But, you know, that's certainly a possibility, even if it's not in reality the case.
I think it's also really important to understand, well, first of all, to remember that Bernanke for years now has been hammering on the threat of deflation. In fact, we've even had guests on the show who have hammered on this threat of deflation. But it's also important to remember how inflation and deflation work. And probably the easiest way to visualize the whole thing is if you visualize the analogy of the balloon. You take a balloon and you put it to your mouth and you start blowing it up and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, that's inflation. And it's a very good analogy of what happens to the money supply. The money supply gets bigger and bigger and bigger as you pour more and more money into it. Well, same thing with that balloon. The more air you pour in, the more the balloon gets bigger. You could say that hyperinflation is where you add air at a tremendous rate, faster than human lungs could do. You put it up to a machine, it just starts pouring air into it. And you could say that the explosion where the balloon finally can't contain any more air and just kind of, you know, bursts a big hole in it, well, that's the ultimate deflation. And it happens very quickly and very explosively. So in a way, even by arguing in favor of inflation, I think it is very clear what Bernanke's trying to do. He's trying to inflate. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. His whole thing is about inflation. It's been inflation for the last 3 or 4 years since the financial crisis in 2008, and it's going to continue to be that. He's made it very, very clear that that's what it's going to do. But, of course, if you have that inflation that leads to hyperinflation, that leads to the bursting of the balloon, guess what you get? You get deflation.
So, massive deflation.
Massive catastrophic deflation.
Or
of course,
collapse.
That destroys economies, you know. So in a very peculiar and underhanded way, I mean, Bernanke's right. That's what the real threat is, and he's creating it.
Yeah, that kind of deflation.
Oh, God, it's awful. Well here in our own country, of course, we have plenty of problems that are being created besides the ones created by Ben Bernanke, and President Obama gave his State of the Union message as required by the Constitution. He gave it this year. And, Gene, I believe you have some details about not only the speech, but perhaps some fact-checking that needs to be done on that speech.
Yeah, and it prompted me to bring this up as I heard a very good program on NPR where they did a fact check on the speech, and they were very factual, and they avoided opinions. But all I could find is USA Today, and there are some opinions in here. But let's take a look at it. This first statement that he said that they brought up is, we can either settle for a country where a shrinking number of people do really well, while a growing number barely get by, or we can restore an economy where everyone gets a fair shot and everyone plays by the same rules. I don't know what point he was restoring it to, but that's what he said. And what they bring up is what Obama is actually proposing is more specific tax changes to deal with the income inequality, a 30% effective income tax rate on millionaires and billionaires. It's called the Buffett rule, and a limit to the number of deductions that households making more than a million can make. And a Brookings Institute fellow, Elizabeth Jacobs, mentions it's curious that what is now counted as the wealthy to the president is those who make $1 million or $1 billion rather than $250,000, which he campaigned on originally. And it goes on to say the prospects for any significant individual tax overhaul are extremely slim, considering it's an election year anyway. His next statement, he said, let there be no doubt, America is determined to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, and I will take no options off the table to achieve that goal. But a peaceful resolution of this issue is still possible and far better, and if Iran changes course and meets its obligations, it can rejoin the community of nations. And this is definitely, isn't that interesting?
Where are they now, in the purgatory?
I guess they're in their own little world, according to Obama. Anyway, this is where they kind of get opinion in here. The reality check says Obama certainly has had his share of foreign policy successes over the last year. He followed through with a campaign promise to end the war in Iraq. A team of U.S. Navy SEALs hunted down and killed Osama bin Laden in May, and the U.S. supported NATO-led operation in Libya that culminated with the ouster of Gaddafi. So I obviously look at that as opinions rather than a fact check. And it goes on to say that at least one potential national security landmine lies ahead, Iran. The GOP presidential hopefuls have hammered Obama on his Iran policy, suggesting his administration has been feckless in thwarting Iran's purported admission to become a nuclear-armed country and was slow to embrace Iranian democracy protests in 2009. It goes on to say it's going to be a big issue, obviously. Anyway, his next statement was, nowhere is the promise of innovation greater than an American-made energy. Over the last 3 years, we've opened millions of acres, new acres for oil and gas exploration. And tonight I'm directing my administration to open more than 75% of our potential offshore oil and gas resources. And they did actually open the Gulf back up. Right now, American oil production is the highest that it's been in 8 years. Not only that, last year we relied less on foreign oil than in any past 16 years. It goes on to say the reality check was the president called for developing a roadmap for safe development of shale gas, which he said could support more than 600,000 jobs by the end of the decade, and called for new incentives for the private sector to upgrade equipment, which could save companies billions and billions of dollars. Republican lawmakers have lashed out at his decision to reject the permitting of the Keystone Pipeline. This is something I find very interesting. If we're truly a republic, other than the federal lands that the pipeline would be on, what role does the federal government have in the pipeline? I would think that it should be orchestrated by the states. Of course, that would make any pipeline much more difficult, which I think it should be, but apparently, do you guys have any clue on this? Does the federal government just say, hey, put that pipeline in from border to border, and they're allowed to do it, or what?
Well, talking about whether they do it rightfully or talking about whether they do it factually are two different things.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, factually, we know the federal government's going to do it, so, you know, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, at time. It does say that, and it backs them up, the U.S. dependence on foreign oil is below 50% for the first time in 13 years. Lower imports are the result of lower demand caused by a sluggish economy, and growth in production is largely due to the industry's ability to extract oil from shale rock in North Dakota in the Bakken area. So, and I also have read that the amount of permits is far above the Bush administration's, who was an oil guy, level. So it is factual on that point. His next statement, he says, I'm sending this Congress a plan that gives every responsible homeowner the chance to save about $3,000 a year on their mortgage by refinancing at historically low interest rates. No more red tape.
Did he actually say every American?
It says here, every responsible homeowner.
Every responsible homeowner.
Not everybody.
No irresponsible homeowner. I don't know if I'd qualify.
And this is a program that only 1 million people can qualify for. So
yeah,
that must
exactly.
mean that there are 299 irresponsible Americans.
Yeah, well, obviously. And who's the guy that judges which ones are responsible? I'd like to meet him. Anyway, the reality check says the plan appears to be a significant expansion of previous efforts to help homeowners refinance their mortgages. The problem, as many homeowners know, is that many homes are worth less than the mortgage payoff, making it difficult to refinance in the first place. The last statement he said is, if you're an American manufacturer, you should get a bigger tax cut. If you're a high-tech manufacturer, we should double the tax deduction you get for making products here. And he actually went on for quite a while about this. And they really don't fact-check this because I don't think there's anything they have an opinion on here that's really not even worth repeating. But I don't think there's really anything concrete in his plan, which would be good, you know, if he could attack the tax code, make it more fair and equitable, and you don't have you know, that's always good. But, you know, it's typical. I thought it was a great campaign speech, not much of anything else.
I like the use of the word feckless.
Yeah, I did too.
First of all, I had to look up the word. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what the word feckless meant. And when I looked it up, it said, well, there are two definitions. First definition, lacking in efficiency or vitality. And then the second definition really caught my attention, unthinking and irresponsible. And I figured, well, you know, the Republicans calling Obama unthinking and irresponsible, that seems quite appropriate because if there's anybody who would know about unthinking and irresponsibility, it would be the Republicans. So, I mean, who better to describe him as being feckless? I thought that was very appropriate.
I agree. I kind of like the first one, lacking in vitality. You know, it's like they think he should already have bombed them, you know.
I think the lacking of vitality part, that talks about the Republican sex scandals, you see. So,
have a few minutes left here. I want to touch on at least one more article before we run out of time here. Jake, you had something that caught my attention, so I'll pass the headline back to you. The Pentagon wanting to use drones instead of soldiers to save money. What's that about?
Sure. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has come out today announcing how the Obama administration plans to achieve $487 billion in cuts over the next decade, in part by reducing the numbers of ships, planes, and troops, but continuing to fund elite special forces and also to support technologies such as the unmanned drones. And again, it's not as if they're actually cutting the military by $487 billion. They're proposing to cut $487 billion from the trillions of dollars that are projected over the next 10 years. So there's really no cuts going on whatsoever. The Pentagon budget is $6 billion less than last year. So it's roughly stable. But when you factor in that the Pentagon gets money from other departments, such as the Treasury, Department of Homeland Security, et cetera, really our defense budget, defense spending is probably either plateauing or continuing to go up, even though we've ended the Iraq war. Possibly the future of our military is becoming more roboticized with these unmanned drones out there. I'm trying to get the actual budget numbers on the drones, and it doesn't look like they actually nail it down here, but they say they're going to ramp up by 30% the number of combat air patrols that Predator drones fly daily. Also kind of interesting is that they don't say where these combat patrols are. They're probably over the Middle East and Afghanistan. There's probably also some over our country as well. Hopefully the CIA will bat out of this as well, because they have been operating those drones for quite some time.
It's interesting on these budget talks, Newt was talking, just a couple, three or four different quotes I saw in speeches, he's just pushing the NASA program because, you know, in Florida it's such a huge, huge part of the welfare program down there. And, you know, it's funny, supposedly he's a Republican and he's looking to cut the budget, but he was just, you know, saying it was a disgrace, these cuts to NASA, the NASA program, and I'm going to push for, you know, a manned spaceflight to a different solar system. He's going on and on and on. I tell you.
It's craziness, there's no doubt about it. We got maybe 3 minutes left. I have one more article I want to include. This comes from Bloomberg.com, and it's entitled Greek Default Looms with a Touch of Schadenfreude, the ticker. And Schadenfreude in German means glee. So basically the headline reads, Greek default looms with a touch of glee. The article says, patience is running out. We are now in the third calendar year of Europe's sovereign debt crisis, and the region's number one problem child, Greece, is looking more and more like a hopeless case. With a new rescue package of 130 billion euros, the country might be bankrupt by March. I'm sorry, without that rescue package. Calls for Europe's northern countries, notably Germany, to show more solidarity with their weaker neighbors have been based on the assumption that nations such as Greece are willing but unable to repay their towering debt. But what if austerity isn't in the Greek vocabulary and the government in Athens doesn't want to change? Surely that blunts any incentive for benevolence from foreign taxpayers. They have a quote that says, you have to doubt whether Greece even wants to become competitive in the currency union. That's written by Holger Stelzner, one of the publishers of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. The elites, he says, in Athens don't appear willing to abandon their own sinecures, hey, that's another great word, or to fight corruption and tax evasion. And he calls for more bailout money for the peripheral nations. A Greek exit from the euro could have a disciplining effect and lead to a stronger eurozone, writes George Eigendorf in the daily newspaper Die Welt. So I guess the way the whole thing sums up is there may be a Greek default, there may be a Greek exit, and maybe the European countries will be celebrating it. Very strange things, but things to be taking close attention to as we get closer. Well, we're near the end here. I just wanted to remind everybody, following our show, there is the premiere of the Occupy the Hood Radio. That's a new program that is hosted by the original founders of the Occupy the Hood movement. That's next year on PRN, so you want to stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, guys, we're at the end of our program, and as usual, it's been a pleasure.
Okay, see you guys next week.
We'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
See you, everyone.